G'day and welcome to another segment of the Build Me a Brewery podcast. My name is Chris Hayton. Last week we released our segment on financing and capital raising. We now move into our small business and accounting considerations when it comes to not only starting and running a brewery, but essential advice that carries principles that can be applied to the running of any successful small business. Brewing is only a small part of it all, and therefore I wanted to sit down with business and accounting savvy experts related to the brewing industry who can share some insights on best ways to structure the business when starting out and what the bookkeeping and accounting responsibilities are for small business owners, as well as advice around excise tax. We also dive into interesting recommendations for software to better organize and time manage these responsibilities, as well as discussions around cash flow management within the world of commercial brewing. Today's episode is part one of our two-episode segment for small business and accounting considerations, and I sit down with Jared Wilson from Craft Accounting. Now, Jared isn't just an accountant who is good with the numbers and the books. He's also a massive craft beer enthusiast and adds some really interesting industry insights related to the finance and accounting aspects of running a brewery. He has extensive experience working with clients in and around the brewing and beverage industry, where he got his first taste of working in the industry starting out with the Australian Brewery as the financial controller, where Jared quickly came to be acquainted with the craft beer scene and the most effective ways of navigating the books and financial responsibilities of a successful brewery. Since moving on from the Australian almost a decade ago, Jared formed his own firm called Craft Accounting, working and helping some of the biggest names in the craft beer and hospitality scene. So let's kick on. I hope you enjoy part one of the segment with Jared Wilson from Craft Accounting. Welcome, Jared, to the Build Me a Brewery podcast. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Yep, thanks for having me.
The whole purpose of today's episode is just to discuss all the small business and accounting considerations that go into starting a small business. And I was very excited to get you on because you have a lot of experience when it comes to the craft beer or craft brewing industry. A lot of your clientele are breweries pretty much all in Sydney, New South Wales. Have you got other interstate clients as well?
I have a couple up in Queensland, so they're just a small distillery. And but yeah, I've got a few floating around. So
yeah, nice. So and that's predominantly, I mean, I could have had any accounting or accountant on and discuss sort of the basics, but I thought it'd be a lot of relevance to share about, you know, all the different considerations and challenges a brewery owner has on the small business and accounting aspects. So love to sort of pick your brain about all that. And but I guess before we get into the bread and butter stuff, are you able to tell us a bit about, you know, yourself, how you got into the accounting space, and maybe just some craft beer or home brewing related sort of stories that, you know, how you got a passion for it, I guess.
Yeah, so I'd been working in public practice in accounting for around 10 years before I was playing baseball with the Hills Heat, and I was well known for bringing a 10-litre keg along to the games with a beer gun. So after the game, we'd all be drinking schooners, and I think at some stage or another, the other guys must have got sick of it, because one day the financial controller at the Australian Brewery turned up and they said, "Oh, Jared, do you know what Paul does for a living?" And like, "Oh, no." And yeah, sure enough, financial controller at the Australian Brewery. And so after hassling him for a job for a few weeks, he was nice enough to invite me in for an interview. And yeah, sure enough, I got a job with them. But yeah, so 10 years in public practice, then 5 years with the Australian Brewery. Basically, in terms of brewing wise, I was a kit and kilo kind of guy as well. I then went into All Grain about 5 years ago, and it was a perfect place to kind of do that, because you could sit there and you know, pick the minds of the Neil Camerons and Dan Shaws and stuff like that. And yeah,
excellent. And the amount of people I've had on this show that have actually said they started out with a kit and kilo, it's yeah, it's like Glenn from the Grifter says, it's sparked a lot of careers in the industry. The whole Cooper kits and all that. Was it Cooper's kit, was it?
Almost definitely. But I then upped my game a little bit.
Yeah.
Added the few better ingredients and stuff like that. Yeah. But yeah, after a while, I think you are from where I am now, I actually need to go further and start investing in all the fancy fermenters and stuff
like
that.
Yeah.
I've got just the 50 liter kit at home, but it's been a while since it's been given a run, because since I've had a fourth child, trying to spend 6 hours in the garage is a bit of a luxury.
I've experienced that just recently as well. I've got a 3 week old, so very fresh, and I'm starting to work out how I'm going to do all this whilst managing a small little family. And like you said, 4 to 6 hours in the garage, it's hard to sort of hide away from the wife and the little one, so let alone four kids. So
I got away with the first three all right. It was number four that kind of sank the ship on that one.
Oh, yeah. So I guess your love starting out with the Australian brewery and, you know, a love of beer has sort of led you down a path of focusing a lot of your practice and services towards the craft beer industry. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, after working at the Australian for 5 years, you get pretty good at it. I mean, essentially, if you're doing all grain at that same time, you really pay a lot of attention into the inputs and what can make that business run better. So I suppose when we first started at the Australian, they used to use a pretty clunky old program. By the time I left, we ended up implementing ECOS, which is a brewing software. That made everything run a lot smoother, and you know, the guys there still use it today. So you definitely don't want to be running any kind of brewing company on just your stock standard QuickBooks and Xero software.
Mm. Well, that's what I'd like to dive in a bit more detail about as well, on how to set that up, the back end and the software side. So just a few more fun things to get to know you as well. Any favorite craft breweries? You probably got a bit of a soft spot for the Australian, but any others you'd like to mention? You want to maybe play favorites or even beer styles or beers there out on the market?
Yeah, look, I'm pretty lucky that I get to work with the Akasha Brewing a lot, so I'm an IPA man. So you know, they're kind of the kings of IPA, kind of floating around. Yeah. Sorry to everyone else. but in terms of other breweries that I don't do a lot of work for, so Yulee's, I think, have some really good, clean, approachable beers that, you know, they essentially just never make a bad beer. And I'll be pretty happy to see the end of Hazy's, I got to say. I like a nice, just normal IPA West Coast. But Hazy's aren't so bad. It's probably more when they start putting lactose in everything. But in saying that, I don't mind a Mountain Culture beer either. So
yeah, those guys are doing some great stuff, and I'm also on of the opinion about the Hazy's as well. I don't know, it doesn't appeal to me. I think it's, I always consider a Hazy to be very, I like a decent amount of carbonation in my beer, and the Hazy's just don't do it for me for some reason.
Yeah, no, I'm on the same boat on that one. Just give me an IPA any day of the week, or just a decent pale ale. Yeah. I'm pretty happy with. But lagers generally, they're a bit more sensitive to hops. You can't, you can hop them too hard, but they get a bit sulfury. So they, definitely more of an ale, man.
Yeah, excellent. All right. So I guess diving into some of the bread and butter things that I'd like to cover in this episode. So, you know, the small business and accounting basics. So I guess starting off, you know, why should an aspiring small business or brewery look at using an accountant?
Okay, so first off, I mean, you can get away, it depends on your size, right? So you'll definitely need a tax agent to look after your tax returns and BASs generally. Most people, your bookkeeper can do your BAS for you, but where we operate mostly is on the larger size brewery where they need management reporting. So a lot of the time, come the 10th to 12th of the month, everyone needs to know how the last month went. And it's quite important that, you know, especially from we kind of look after everything from start to finish. So we do the tax services, the month-end reporting. We focus on software integrations and the debt collecting, supply management, bookkeep, the lot of it, right? So in terms of why you should use us, it's more a function of your size. So where we have smaller contract brewers come on, we try to stay out of their hair as they kind of kick off and find their feet. It's the bigger guys we operate more with. With startups, we do all the, you know, helping them out with their excise licenses and jazz like that. But it's more the month-end reporting, making sure your stock is correct, making sure your profit and loss is correct. That's where we operate best.
Mm, excellent. And so do you have any clientele that are at that gypsy contract brewing level?
There's a fair few, or not a fair few, there's a couple of smaller ones that operate out. So you've got your From Bens. There's another couple of guys that I won't name them just in case, but they are, yeah. And they all kind of come in they can generally run on a stock standard software. It's when they start to get a bit larger that they start to need manufacturing specific software.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because it's, I guess, no secret to the audience that it's a model that has interested me as well. And it's interesting to know, how early on some of these people are engaging sort of professional services like yourself to assist with that side. I guess it depends on how long they're looking at pursuing that as a model before they actually invest in a physical brewery. So yeah.
The good part about contract brewing is you can dip your toes in and you don't have to stay in there for an extended period. At the end of it, you don't have to, if you decide you want out or it's not making money, you don't have to sell your kit, make good on the leased area and stuff like that. You can, and there's a long list of names of contract brewers who have been around, and I think Glenn brought up a few in his podcast the other day that good contract brewers in their day did it pretty much as a part-time gig, but then just let it go essentially at one time and just continued on with the rest of their life. Once you've got a whole lot of stainless steel, you're really committed. So I'd say, you know, and there's a fair few guys who've gone into contract brewing and done it very well. Like if you look at the Yulees, the Filters and stuff like that, they've sat there and built the brand, gone to the bank and said, show me the money, right? Because they've already got that turnover there.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of midway through a business plan. You can sit there and give them all the numbers you want, but in their terms, they can sit there and say, this is what we've done. This is the audience we've got. We need you to help us save money so we can build this business, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And you would have been able to see the figures and the cash flow or the profit and loss for some of these gypsy brewers or contract brewers. And, I mean, the theme is that, yes, it's a good model to sort of start off with and build a brand and then invest in a physical brewery, but it's not a sustainable model from what a lot of people are telling me. But then I hear some stories that, you know, people have been doing it for years, and, you know, Glenn from the Grifter said, you know, they weren't making a loss. If anything, that was funding their operation. But, you know, and I've spoken to other people like Steve Henderson, Hendo from Rockstar Brewer, which is going to an episode that's going to follow in later on in this podcast series. But, you know, he's of the mindset that it's, you know, you cannot make money in the gypsy brewing model, and maybe back in the days when the Grifter guys were doing it, but definitely not these days.
Again, it'll come down to pricing and distribution. I think what Glenn said the other day is they essentially had Matt running on petrol money, and he would go and do everything, and the other guys kept their other jobs, and they just built the cash from there. There's other guys I do work for that they have an outlet, right, and they can just sell from that outlet. So the parents own a pub or whatever it is, and that they've got a few taps there that they can just run off, and they make a few dollars. They don't have to pay for a sales guy, and they can just run the brand from there. That's a lot easier method of doing it if you've got a tap room. I think what you saw with Hendo, he had a rather large core range, and the one thing that'll sink you is paying for storage and distribution. If you're going to sit there and do his model, obviously he went into the pub game a little bit later, but you would want your own logistics center to be able to move those brands. Now, that's not cheap in itself, especially if you're trying to move it around from Sydney, and you may be better off using a third-party logistics at that stage, but Brewcock got quite large.
Yeah.
So it's unlucky, and, you know, yeah, it's one of those things that happened with him because they'd gone and built the pub as well.
Yeah, and that was without revealing too much because, you know, episode hasn't aired yet, but one comment he did share is that he probably did overstretch himself and has probably caused a little bit of bitterness towards the gypsy contract brewing model. And, you know, he's of the mind that just go straight, put every cent and dollar straight into just doing a brew pub or production brewery if that's the way you want to go. But I've heard a lot of other comments and feedback on the other side that it, you know, as long as it's a way to get into owning your own physical brewery, it's still a practical model to start out with. So
I think so. I mean, even if you can get your hands on a tap house, so even if you've got, you know, some sort of outlet retail, you can quite easily sit there and contract out to someone at Rocks or something like that and sit there and get good movement on your beer. Yeah. If you've got a good tap house in a good area, it's very possible. But it's definitely, it's hard to scale. So essentially, like, even if you go and build a brewery, right, and so you're not contracting out your production, but you contract out your 3PL, you contract out your packaging, you contract out your keg star, right? So you're not using your own keg fleet, right? So someone's handling your going and getting kegs every day. They're three main things that if you can cut those back, there's good money to be made, right? But a lot of people will enjoy the luxury of just having someone else do that for them because it's a lot easier. Having a canning line, like East Coast Canning are very good at making sure you're not going to have any issues with your cans and anything else, right? And that's where they come to the forte. But they are expensive and they're a direct cost. And same with your 3PL and same with your keg star. The more you sell, the more that cost will follow your turnover. Once you start to bring things in-house, that's where you start to bring those things back towards your break-even point. So they become a fixed cost. So you hire a logistics guy, you buy your own keg fleet, and you have your own cool room where you move your own stock. That's where you can have a think about what you are contracting out, like, because there's various things. The more you can bring in-house, the more you can make a margin on the product you're selling as you grow.
We dived a lot into the Gypsy Brewery model, but back onto the accounting. I guess it was a nice note. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of much more insight into the industry than just the numbers side, which is really good to know. And I guess that would make you, I guess, a good service to the industry, knowing all those sort of different elements of what to consider and all that. So, but I guess one thing that I'd like to know early on in the piece is, you know, I've got another couple of business partners, mates that are considering getting involved in this venture with me. And I guess it's always important to make sure you're structuring your business right from the very beginning. And what is some important takeaways for structuring the business if you're going in with multiple business partners?
Yeah, so if you're going in with multiple guys, you're going to need a shareholder agreement from the very start. So it's very important that, you know, if things start to blow up and you're actually not getting along that well because you might be making losses at first, other people are putting in money, other people aren't putting in money, you need to have a mechanism to kind of cut the cord, essentially, right? But in terms of structuring, so you're always going to run with a company or a corporate entity with for a brewery. What you will do there is you would then, in terms of shareholding, to give yourself some sort of flexibility, and it depends on what your family situation is as well. If you're just a guy, no wife, family, you're probably just going to be better off owning those shares personally, again, depending on your financial situation. If you want the ability to split your income later, right, you're going to have the shares in the company held by family trusts. Now, these are expensive to set up and they're expensive to maintain, but if you do start to make bank, right, it's a worthwhile investment originally. So between the two, it'll be about $2,000 each to get it all set up, but it'll give you flexibility later on in terms of how you can distribute any earnings. And especially like on sale, for instance, if you do go and sell the business later, you make a profit on that sale, you can then split that and still take advantage of all the capital gains tax concessions. You can still take advantage of it if you hold the shares personally, but you've got more flexibility if you've got that family trust there, essentially. In terms of why you operate as a company as a whole instead of a sole trader or a partnership, it comes down to two things. So R&D rebates, so research and development, and your loss carryback provisions, which are brand new as of the budget a couple of months back. So in terms of R&D, if you are making a loss in that first year, which you could probably pencil in, you can get R&D rebates back on your expenditure on product development, essentially. So the money you're spending on your product development, making sure that it's over 20 grand, you can then start to get 43 cents in the dollar back on. Okay, so that's a good, nice little cash injection back in that first year. Alternatively, say you're a few years older, because it's not going to be very helpful if you're a brand new business now, but where you got the loss carryback provision, so say 2019, you were very profitable. 2020, you've made a big fat loss because COVID's hit you quite hard. In your 2021 tax return, you can actually get the tax you paid in 2019 assuming you haven't gone and paid it out as a dividend. Now, that's pretty complicated, and loss carryback's not easy, but if you do need information on it later, we can provide that. But that's why you're going to go for a corporate entity, because your trust can't get it either. So that's why you would have your trust as your shareholder and not as your operating entity. I've seen at least two or three breweries that operate as a unit trust that have missed out on 4 or 5 years worth of rebates, which hurts to watch. Mm. But yeah, so that's why I'd run with a corporate entity.
Yeah, and that also offers you protection as well against any personal assets as well if the business does go under.
Not really.
No?
No, so you've got limited liabilities, but so what you'll find when you go to run a business these days is most of your big suppliers will make you sign a director's guarantee to mm-hmm. so they will have, they essentially step around the corporate veil and make you personally liable. Secondly, the ATO has become more and more aggressive, and it's nothing the brewing industry has done. This is all a construction phoenixing scheme issue where they've walked off with about $1.2 trillion worth of GST. So now you're essentially, as a director of a business, it's not the best time to be a director of a business. You're now personally liable pretty much for all your taxes. So your GST, wet tax, excise tax, PAYG, superannuation. Essentially what the ATO will do, if they have the impression you're about to go into administration or you're really struggling, which they're going to be the first ones to tell, because let's face it, unfortunately, the ATO are the last ones to get paid in terms of suppliers, they'll issue a director's penalty notice and say they'll make you personally liable for that. Okay, so that's when you're in a bad way, you want to try and find some money pretty quickly, because they will actually come for your house. Although I haven't seen the ATO being too aggressive in that stance in the brewing industry, but I've seen plenty of directors' penalty notices previously.
So that was always an attraction that the proprietary limited model was, that it had this, well, I guess you never completely protected, but there was a layer of protection there. That layer is still somewhat there, but you're saying that there is still, depending on the circumstances and how motivated the ATO is or collectors are, there's still a way for you to be impacted personally.
Yeah, so where they're unsecured suppliers kind of coming for you later, yeah, sure, they'll have to deal with the administrator later if they're unsecured. But like I said, a lot of these guys are pretty good at doing the personal guarantee to make sure that they can step around that anyway.
Well, okay, well, that's an eye-opener. So,
yeah.
All right, so what model or what structure of the business would you recommend as, I guess, the preferred option for a multiple partnership getting into the brewing industry?
Yeah, I'd still run with the company. I'd still run with the structure I told you previously, with the family trusts owning the shares. You could have extra layers. So you could have the shares owned by a unit trust and then the family trust or individuals owning the units in the unit trust. But that's probably just overcomplicating it. Then you've got, you know, all these trustee companies floating around everywhere and you know, no one understands what's going on. So,
yeah. Okay. And Jared, one thing in my research so far, I've learned that, you know, there's two main ways to manage a business's books. And one is cash basis and the other is accrual accounting. Are you able to talk about the two and I guess maybe what the pros and cons are for each?
Yeah, look, so cash basis is basically where you haven't been paid for the goods yet. You don't really want to pay tax on it just yet. So where you get the occasional bad debtor, you won't pay tax on that on a cash basis. But the cons of running on a cash basis is you're not going to get paid by your, you're not going to get the GST credits on your suppliers that you haven't paid either. And the Cry Malts and Hot Products Australia and stuff like that can definitely add up. And you probably almost definitely want those GST credits to come in before you've paid. A lot of the time, though, it's going to be a pretty mild timing difference. Essentially, even by the time you lodge your GST return, even if you are on a cash basis, you've probably received those funds already. So from our perspective, it's a lot easier to run on an accrual basis because that'll keep everything in line with your accounts going forward. And just accounting for GST on a cash basis is a bit of a pain in the ass. So definitely run with accrual.
Okay, excellent. And what sort of systems would you recommend a small brewery or small business have set up in the beginning, maybe software-wise or, yeah, to sort of help manage and keep track of those things?
So, again, it'll depend on the size of the business. If you're a contract brewer who's expanding in size – you're starting to bring in all your own packaging, and you want to bring in those costs properly so you can start to get a nice precise idea of how much money you're making or losing, then you're going to start to use Unleashed. Unleashed will work for small distillers as well quite well, and I think wineries as well. But essentially what it'll do, it'll just make you be able to assemble the product a lot easier and then turn it into packaging and on-sell it. It'll then link with your Shopify account if you're like your online sales. And look, the integration with Xero is quite simple, but at the same time, that's all you're going to need at that contract brewer stage. But it'll also be able to manage you all the way to a rather large size brewery as well. So Unleashed is good like that. If you're kind of coming from that angle, it's a lot easier to use. Furthermore, if you're going to plan on a bigger operation, you're probably going to be looking at ECOS or Beer 30. ECOS is a good program. You know, it can run all your logistics, sales, all your manufacturing and jazz like that. It is a bit older, and I may say a few rude things about ECOS a bit later, but it will run your business to the 95th degree, essentially. Beer 30 is the new kid in town. It runs a lot better from what I can tell. Mm-hmm. There's still a bit of conjecture as to how good it is in terms of on the sales side, but in terms of the manufacturing side, I find it quite good. But yeah, so if you're a mid-tier size brewery kind of growing, run with something where you can see your brew house. So Beer 30 and ECOS, you can see your brew house, you can see all, you know, your fermenters, bright tanks, barrels, if you want to have barrels in there as well. And you can tell from there, you can forecast everything a lot better. Also in terms of excise, those two report a lot better. Beer 30 more than ECOS. ECOS is still a little bit clunky where you've got to make your own reports. Beer 30 can essentially be set up to have all your bonded warehouses put in place already, and have your sales. So essentially you can click a button and have your excise tax return done. The downside of Beer 30 is it's more expensive. It's probably double the price of where ECOS is. But in saying that, it'll probably save you money in getting your excise tax return done. So in terms of cost saving, it'll probably save you time over this side, but it'll definitely cost you money up front. So definitely a lot cheaper than NetSuite, put it that way.
Yeah, I'm glad you did bring that up, because I've only just recently started chatting with PK, who's the CEO of Beer 30. He reached out and wanted to talk a bit about the software and how it integrates with a brewery, and so I'm aiming to actually have him on at a later point in the podcast to explain and talk a bit about it. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, cool. So yeah, so look, a lot of our clients run ECOS, so that's the program I use day to day, and it's got its quirks. So in terms of, like, you'll go through it a bit later, but in terms of getting paid by your customers, the fact a few things don't integrate properly on the information side, so passing back emails and phone numbers and stuff like that, they it's a bit of a hole in the program, unfortunately.
Yeah, and listen, I know PK's probably got his motivations as to why he said this, but he said that there is still some paper-based or manual sort of tasks that are still involved with ECOS, where that's where he saw a bit of a gap with the software that they released. So
yeah, definitely. I mean, in terms of they go a lot more into the data capture area, yeah, where, you know, with ECOS you'll have guys still walking around with their with the notepads, essentially still, you know, taking attenuations and stuff like that, whereas you should still be putting that all in ECOS, I might add. You can enter a lot of that information, but it's definitely better with the data capture. It does a whole lot of graphs that are kind of handy, especially from the brewing side, but at the same time, I mean, if you set up ECOS properly, you can get some pretty good reporting out of there. I know Akasha just run on a dashboard all day, and they've just got it up on the big TV, just, you know, showing everyone where their sales are and where everything else is, so everyone knows where everything is.
Yeah, very good. And any other sort of software or apps maybe that would make, I guess, a small business owner or brewery owner's life a bit easier? I've tried sort of having a look at some. I know that there's ones there to make receipting a lot easier and so forth, but any from your experience?
Yeah, so what we use is Lightyear. So Lightyear will help manage all your suppliers. It's essentially an electronic filing cabinet. You send a PDF to it, it maps it and you go from there. You can use it for receipts as well, but the receipt side of it is fairly clunky. Right. So there's various ways you can deal with your receipts. So if you use QuickBooks, so for employee receipts, generally what people use will be Expensify. Expensify, again, it's a very good program. Essentially, you just take a photo of the receipt. It reads it for you. You then choose what category you want to put it to. Then I, as the accountant, will sit there and approve it. If you use Xero, just use Xero expenses. That's fine. You would still use Lightyear for your suppliers, but just use Xero expenses. It's a nice, easy program to use. So,
okay. Yeah, excellent. I'd like you to, I guess, share some thoughts on what are all the, if you're able to break it down in a nice simple list, what are all the responsibilities a brewery owner has when it comes to the accounting aspect? So, you know, the sales tax, BAS, excise. So are you able to give us a, you know, what they need to be considering?
Yep. So on the monthly basis, you need to lodge your GST returns. So that'll have, you know, your net GST plus your PAYG withholding on wages. As you get bigger, you'll have PAYG withholding on a monthly basis. And given on how well you operate, you'll end up with tax installments as well. That's essentially a prepaid tax on your year's tax, essentially. From there, so then you've got excise tax. So if you're owned by one of the big guys, so someone over 50 million turnover per year, you've got to lodge on a weekly basis. If you're just a stock standard brewery, you're going to be lodging on a monthly basis by the 21st of the month after the month.
Yeah.
So that's essentially it in terms of taxes. In terms of the excise tax rebates, so you get the 100,000 per year. That's based on 60% of the tax that you've already paid. So once you lodge your July return, right, you would then lodge your July rebate. So you would lodge your rebate, and then you would get that back either in credits or cash in the bank.
Okay. Yeah, because there's been a bit of a reprise lately with that rebate, isn't it? It's at 100,000, like you said, but there's even talks of it even being more in the coming financial year. Is that right?
Yeah, look, I don't think that'll happen, only because I think a lot of the guys are comparing it to the wet tax. Now, the wet tax is 29% on your first $500,000 in turnover. If you do the math, that's $145,000. So I'd say probably the area they want to look at is how it's structured in terms of the wineries, because you've got a lot of, you know, they're just using grape juice a lot of the time. That's not that far different from a contract brewer. So probably the bit I need to look at, so don't quote me here, but I just want to investigate that side and see how the wet tax works there. But otherwise, it's not a big difference as far as I can tell. I know the wine industry had a few issues with companies double claiming at one stage. But in terms of if you want to get two sets of rebates, you got to just start a distillery at the same time, and then you'll be able to get your hands on both of them.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah, yep. And that's starting to become quite a big thing here now, isn't it? A lot of independent distilleries opening.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm. So we do one or two, but yeah, they are. It's something I definitely want to look into, predominantly because it's a skill we can transfer from the brewers to the distillers quite easily. So,
yeah. Well, I've had a couple of people reach out to me saying that they're interested in the distilling, opening their own distillery or in the process of, and that they're going to be listening to this podcast because there's a lot of transferable content. And it's maybe an angle I think I possibly will explore at some point in this
podcast. If you're a distiller, probably run with Unleashed. The beer programs so far haven't tailored it to distilling, although I think a lot of them can sit there and set up barrels for you. So if you do want to use the beer programs, you probably can use them, but yeah.
Yeah, excellent. All right, so you've gone through, I guess, the ATO and excise responsibilities and talked a bit about the excise tax rebates available to breweries. I guess what I'd like to also explore is I've never owned or ran a small business before. A lot of people listening probably haven't. You know, starting this brewery for them will possibly be the very first business venture that they do. What are some things or advice that you can offer them to become a bit more business savvy in terms of understanding finances and profit and loss and budgeting and forecasting?
Yeah, in terms of overall understanding of how your business works. It's a bit of a tricky one because essentially you need to understand the accounting function. So when you go in there, and if you get a bookkeeper or accountant or whatever it is, what you want to make sure of is the information coming out is correct. You might be a lot smaller operation, but essentially once you start to turn over a fair bit, you've got a fair bit in terms of your break-even point. Your break-even point is probably one of the most important parts of understanding. You know, if you're going to run a tap house, you're probably going to run on a 70% margin a lot of the time. You need to know what your break-even is going to be and what you need to turn over to make a profit. Same thing with the production side. You can aim for 50. You're probably going to land around 40 by the time, you know, your sales guys discount everything. You know, you need to know what they need to sell on a month-by-month basis to keep everything afloat, because you don't want to have to start letting people go, essentially, right? You want to build and keep going in the right direction. You don't want to splutter along. Make sure you have a good relationship with your bank. That's probably a key one as well.
Mm.
But yeah, in terms of budgeting, look, you can use the QuickBooks and Xero to set your budgets as well. But essentially, that's probably something you want more in a spreadsheet where you can sit there and just map it on a month-by-month basis. And essentially, especially in terms of brewing, making sure your sales guys know exactly what their sales targets are. And if they don't make them, you've got to kind of make them accountable as well. So,
Yeah, and that's another element, the staffing side, which is another thing that people probably might not consider in the very beginning. And, you know, I'm starting to be educated about, you know, exploring topics around the you know, what it means to manage staff and sort of the HR element of it as well. So and sales is a big thing. If you don't have sales behind the brewing part, then you're not going to be in business much longer.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, the sales guys essentially fund everything, don't they? But it's what you see as businesses start to grow and they go, okay, we need to grow. They're kind of plodding along and they go, okay, we need more fermenters, we need sales guys, you need marketers, essentially. And they're big costs that, you know, if your new sales guy doesn't hit the ground running, you're going to have a bit of lag there. And again, that's why you need a good relationship with the bank.
Mm. So when I guess someone is in that stage of planning their brewery, you know, they're probably best off doing a business plan. Is that something that you would assist in? I know some accounting firms will have in their service offering some business plan assistance or something like that.
Yeah, look, most of the time people come to me and they've got a site set up already, or they've got their eyes on a site, and they're moving towards making sure their figures are correct, because essentially, you know, most people will sell their house and start looking for investors to kind of fund the rest of it. What you'll find with the banks is they won't lend a lot straight off unless you've got a really good history with them and you've done a whole lot of stuff previously. They'll sit there and say, nah, you know, you're going to need to go find more equity to get this up and running. So we don't essentially write business plans, but we will give you advice on what you're doing all the way through the process, and then more act as a facilitator. And it's one of those things, it's catch-22. Some guys will come across from the Neils and Brady Frenches and stuff like that, where they say, oh, you need an accountant, go see Jared first, get everything set up. And then by the time you've found your site, done your budgets, approach people for finance, then the brewing consultants kind of come on board and move everything forward. So so essentially we don't write business plans. Maybe that's something I can work on. But what we will do is give advice on. So when they do have the business plan, we'll sit there and say, you're probably going in the wrong direction there. You probably need to go off there.
So more of a fine tuning, really.
Yeah, correct. And again, when they're giving them the business plan, a lot of the time there'll be a lot of figures involved, and we'll help prepare those figures. But again, it's a finger in the air. It's a lot different when you see someone who hasn't been in the industry before turn up with a business plan, as opposed to someone who's a bit of a veteran, they're doing another project, and they turn up just, you know, kind of moving outside their normal sphere. They want a new accountant, so they'll come to me, and you can just see in the plans that those guys have got that they've done it before, and they don't really need you for anything. They just, you know, need to fine tune a few things and ask a few questions and go from there. So
yeah, I think the one part of, like, I've written a business plan in my current role, you know, managing a business center and so forth. But I guess what sort of is a bit cloudy to me is understanding the, well, how much I'm going to budget for, or the forecasting, really, to be honest. Working out the price of beer, and, you know, depending on what concept I'm going to go through, whether it's brew pub or production model, tap room sales, etc. I guess understanding is all the numbers that surround it, and trying to come up with a realistic, I guess, forecast to be able to show investors or to show banks that, you know, we expect to be break even in the first year. And then, you know, I guess how putting that all together, and I guess what advice could you share around that?
So I suppose decide on what direction you're going to head in early. And I suppose I heard Glenn say it the other day. So if you take Grifter, for instance, they would have got a canning line a lot earlier. And, you know, I think that's key as well. But once you look at, you know, you've got a DA for 100 people to have in your bar, you know how many people you can get in there. You know you're going to have turnover around 2.5 to 3 people on a Saturday. So you should be able to budget from there how much turnover you're going to have. Try not to overstaff originally. That's always probably one of the main areas people fall into, that they get in a new venture. They go, oh man, this thing is going to kick off real hard. They put in all this staff and it's a ghost town, right? So you really want to build that up as slowly as possible and really understand what staffing levels you need and probably stretch them a bit in the beginning. But at the same time, don't miss the boat, whereas everyone's like, the customer service in this place is terrible. Definitely go with the canning line if you can. If you think about what's happening in the industry at the moment with all the tap contracts and stuff like that, they're not going to improve it. So the ACCC has said, no, we're not doing anything. So that means there's still a really limited amount of taps that you can get out there that aren't your own taps. So really budget on having a big tap room so you don't need a sales guy out there on a day-to-day basis trying to sell your product for you, because that's the one thing you want to avoid. I'd probably prefer to have someone in the tap room selling and making that place perfect than out on the road, you know, going to pubs that have said no to 50 sales guys that day already. But you will need them. If you're going to go get a canning line, you're going to need to budget for a sales guy, put it that way. Or you're going to have to, if one of your partners is a sales guy, make sure he's out there working hard. You don't want some guy going, oh, no, you know, I got into this game so I didn't have to work weekends, because, mate, you're working weekends.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, wrong field to go into if you've left one job because you're working too many hours and you're going to be doing it definitely in the early days opening a brewery. So, yeah, excellent. Can you talk a bit about the importance of cash flow management? Because through some of the conversations I've had with a lot of brewery owners is, you know, especially on the, I guess, talking about the pub side and the kegs, it's probably something that is a lot slow moving in terms of getting your money back. You know, I had Pat from Willie the Boatman talk about, you know, they're pivoting towards more packaging. I mean, COVID has forced their hand, but, you know, they're getting money back from bottle shop owners a lot quicker. But where, you know, you're dealing with the big pub conglomerates, you know, the big organizations, getting money back on the sale of a keg can be quite slow, 30 day plus at times. And if your business model is solely built around kegs, then, you know, you're going to have cash flow problems. Is that right?
Not necessarily, like, especially with the pubs. Like, I mean, hospitality has been through a pretty rough period of late. So it's more a matter of working with your partners. So, you know, go in there. I know obviously people don't like tap contracts and stuff like that, but you need to sit there and essentially support each other. So, you know, what do you need from us? You know, the amount of sales guys who turn up and put a Hotmail address in their EGOS and expect someone to be able to get paid later is kind of crazy. So a lot of the time in terms of debt collecting, what I find, especially with pubs and bar owners, is it's generally up to the sales guy to make sure they've given you the right information. So it's pretty critical to make sure that when you go and do a credit application to that pub, that you get the correct information back. More often than not, you'll get a sales guy, probably more in the beginning than later, but they'll just turn up and they'll get the bar manager's details. And you know what hospitality is like, trying to find that bar manager is going to be quite hard. The amount of guys I've called and they go, mate, I left there 3 months ago. And so it's up to you to make sure you've got the right information. And if the sales guy does put that information in there, you hand it back to him and say, mate, go fill in the correct details and come back in a bit. So that's important. So it's hard to sit there and point the finger at the hotel industry and say, oh, they're slow payers, because generally they're pretty good, especially the RSLs and stuff like that. They're all pretty pinpoint. They've got good systems. Some pubs are just like any other small business. They're just a bit disorganized sometimes. So sometimes they're not paying, don't get me wrong. Sometimes they're slow for a reason. These things happen. But you then either learn not to deal with them or go and work with them even harder and say, look, we're here to support you. You do us a favor, you pay on time, and you work your way around it. So,
Have you heard of an online service now called Caddy at all? Those guys actually reached out to me a couple of weeks ago, and an interesting platform they have. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, Caddy's decent for the industry, right? So on one side, you get paid pretty much straight away. On the other side, they give the bottle shops about 30 days to pay. Like any kind of new platform at the moment, whether it be Square or Caddy, it's all in the transaction cost. So where they're picking up that 2.2%, plus I think they're charging extra now as well for the suppliers. They'll do well for themselves. It's good to a degree, but I mean, where you do work for bottle shops and everyone's forcing you to use Caddy, it becomes a bit hard because, look, I mean, you still get 30-day terms, but essentially I prefer the good old days of just doing business with people and going out there and going, yep, okay, this is how it's going to work. We're going to do deals and we're going to make sure you get paid and you're going to get a discount and we're all going to run from there. That kind of gets taken out of it with the caddies of the world. So that's not to give Caddy any grief at all.
No. And I guess there is always pros and cons of it. I think talking to them briefly, they mentioned that, the motivation behind their platform is to try hold both parties accountable in terms of, making sure people are getting paid on time and customers can easily access and see what stock levels are available for a certain brewery and so forth. So it's an interesting concept, and it seems to be, things that used to be so manual and, I guess paper-based is starting to become so virtual now in terms of processes, et cetera. So,
yeah, well, especially if they could, because, from their perspective, they're ordering from multiple suppliers as well. So if they could hook up with someone like Modus or something like that and just like distribute straight out of their warehouse, that'd be a pretty good gig.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Maybe an idea for them.
Yeah.
I don't know if you covered some parts there about the cash flow side of things, but any out-of-the-box advice you'd give a small brewery owner to get customers to pay on time?
So the same thing I just said then, more just utilize your software. If you're really struggling to get paid and having issues, I'd probably look at Creditor Watch. So I've used Creditor Watch for one of the guys. It's a bit expensive, a couple of grand to get set up, and it costs you around $400 a month. Could be a bit more. I think my guy negotiated pretty well. But essentially, it's a good program in terms of like you can just look up who you're doing business with. They can link it to everyone. So you say you've got 400 customers. It'll tell you if anyone's got people looking at their records or giving them any grief on ASIC or anything like that. So it's good that it flags a whole lot of stuff. But just as a general use, it's probably something I should actually have on hand for craft accounting, because essentially if you've got a new guy turn up, you can just look them up, essentially what other businesses they're a director of. And so Creditor Watch are pretty good. If you're going to be a bigger business and you can fit it into your budget, definitely go with it, yeah.
Mm, yeah, good. Jared, just want to get your insights about the future of the craft beer industry. You sound like you've got a lot of intricate sort of experiences with a lot of breweries. I'm sure you've got some opinions on where you see the craft beer industry going in Australia, maybe from an accounting or financial aspect, or just in general. What do you see the future of the industry?
I think if you're going to be a brewery these days, you've really got to invest in the canning line, and you've got to be able to get your product to market at a decent price. So like I said before, the tap contracts issue isn't going to fix itself. So more than the growth is going to be in pack. So if you want to have the growth in pack, you don't want to be outsourcing one of your key functions, and that being the packaging. So I see the industry just pivoting more and more to pack. I can't see there being too much more growth. I mean, I've worked with the Akasha for a long time, and there hasn't been massive growth in the kegs the entire time, but the packaged product has gone through the roof, and that's the same with anyone I've worked with. And each brewery will tell you the same. So Glenn told you last week from Grifter that, you know, packaging as well. That's the way. You imagine if CUB or Lion went to your local bottle shop and locked up all the fridges, and you only had five or six different fridges, I think everyone would be outraged. So, you know, the fact they're allowed to do it on the tap side of things, I think is a bit rough. So what I'd like to see is there just at least be some sort of limitations as to the amount of taps they can lock up in a brew at any one time. And I think, you know, having listened to a few podcasts of late on what happened with Stone and Wooden Lion of late, that, you know, if the way they're structuring those contracts isn't anti-competitive, I'd be pretty surprised. Then there's a few different ones out there. I mean, that's a newer version of it where they're excluding Stone and Wood, but most of the time they'll just exclude someone under 4 million barrels or something like that per year. It's very anti-competitive. So I think if you imagine if they did that to your bottle shop, like I said, everyone would be up in arms. So I don't think the industry has anywhere else to grow other than tap rooms. So either when you go to start off, have a massive tap room focus, or have a massive packaging focus, essentially.
And that's what I've been told many times on this podcast, is that's where your biggest margins are. And, you know, especially starting out, you need to take advantage of that. If your main goal is to eventually become a production brewery, maximize your taproom sales to eventually, you know, expand into that sort of production level. Would that be sound advice to you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, but again, try and make the decision early, because once... And again, East Coast do a very good job, but once you're kind of locked into using East Coast... Yeah, you're better off, in terms of going back to your cash flow thing, it's a lot easier to pin your finance against an asset, so a canning line or something like that. So when originally when you go to set up, try and pin as much finance to the equipment as possible and keep as much cash for cash flow as possible. It's very important. So, but if you get down through it and you haven't gone and invested in that canning line, it becomes harder and harder. You can go to the bank later and say, yep, once we get our hands on this canning line, we're going to be able to improve our bottom line, and we'll be able to fund the equipment no problem, plus make profits on top of that. But it's a lot harder. You're better off doing it originally when you can afford it.
Yeah,
essentially.
Because that's the thing dealing with a lot of or exploring the equipment side, is canning lines can be almost as much as what your brew house will cost you, some of them, the decent ones. So, and I guess that's why people are a bit, I guess they shy away from investing in a canning line in the first 12 months or 2 years of their operation, is because they just simply can't afford it. They just want to make beer. But what you're saying, but well, Neil Cameron mentioned there's some equipment coming on the market now that is becoming a bit more affordable and is still pretty decent as well. But what you're saying, if you've got it in your budget, buy a can line straight away.
Yeah, definitely. But definitely make sure that equipment is solid. That's probably the main thing. You want to make sure you've got some fairly decent support or someone who's pretty well versed in a canning line. Just dealing with Brody French of late, so he runs Great Beer Advisory.
Yep.
He's pretty good with a canning line, but you're making sure you've got someone overlooking your systems as a whole. You don't want to go and buy a cheaper canning line only to find out that it's, you know, falling apart. You can't get parts for it. You can't get support for it. So that's probably the key. Once that canning line goes down, you're in all kinds of trouble.
Yeah.
So
especially if it's been purchased from, say, somewhere like China, and, you know, you can't get them on the phone as soon as the deal's done. So
yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, or you can't get any support from there. So, without giving Chinese equipment any grief, there's some plenty of good stuff out there. But
no, there is, and we've got a segment coming up very soon where I talk to a lot of like equipment experts, and you know, that sounds like some great stuff still coming out of China. It's definitely improved over the years. So there's still the dodgy stuff, but it's I guess in any sort of country,
any industry,
it's always going to be that. All right, and any sort of thoughts on beer trends? You did talk about the hazies and all that. Sort of out left field beers that you think are going to make a big push for, the craft beer punters?
I don't think so. I mean, hopefully hazies fade away a bit. I don't think they'll go away completely. They're still big in the US, and it's been about 5 years for those guys. So I'd probably like to see some Belgian beers come back. You know, I like a good Belgian beer. But at the same time, I don't think Australia's importing a whole lot of Belgian at the moment. So, I think, you know, same thing as everyone else. Everyone's going to go back lighter and lighter till we're all back at lager again. So,
yeah, well, that's, I can't recall who it was. It might have been Dan from the Australian. I know that you're wearing their shirt as we do this interview. Their Mexican lager, which is quite nice. And I think it was Dan that said that there's starting to be a bit of a push for slightly more eccentric lagers and not the traditional sort of run-of-the-mill lager sort of flavour profiles, but something with a little bit of a twist to it. Have you heard much about the push for lagers in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, the Australian used to make a lot of good lagers. So, most afternoons I'd have their dark lager pretty much, and they had the Pilsner forever and a day as well, but that seems to have met a swift death, unfortunately. But look, in all honesty, I think what you find with Pilsners and lagers as a whole is they don't last in pack, predominantly because they're too close to the big guys, and people, when they can buy a slab of VB, for instance, for $50 and they're paying $20 for four beers for a beer, can you justify why that beer is so much more? Now, I understand from a beer perspective, all the other costs that are involved in creating any kind of beer, not just a Pilsner, but it's the there's a theory on it, but it's replaceable. Right, so people can sit there and say, well, I can get 50 of them as opposed to four, so I'm going to go buy the 50 and fill the fridge with that, and then I'm going to drink ales on the side. So if you're going to go into lager territory, essentially you've got to find some sort of a price point that's palatable to the consumer, or really get a cult following on your lager, which is a bit hard.
And that's how I used to view craft beer, back when I was 18, 20. I mean, there wasn't as much of it around as there is these days, but, you used to always look, you walk into your Dan Murphy's and you were just always looking for anything priced between $45 to $55 or something like that, and anything more than your $60, it was sort of like, nah, I'm not paying that much. And, I got a case of beer for $50 last week. It's like, you walk into Dan's, it's like fuel prices. They would fluctuate massively. You know what I mean? Like, fuck yeah. VB's $60 now. What, it was bloody $45 the other week. But I guess back on the craft beer perspective, you started seeing Little Creatures and even Lashes, James Squire sort of beers come out, and they were pushing the $60-$70 mark price point. You just thought, I'll never buy a case of beer for that much, if I can get beer at $40-$45. But then as you sort of your palate adjusts and you start learning what goes into that beer and all the different sort of flavor profiles you can get from it. And I think like Neil Cameron on an episode I did with him, his sort of thought was the more educated the masses become, the more people start looking at quality in beer and not necessarily price. Hopefully that is a growing trend where people are starting to open their wallets up a little bit more and start pushing the $60-$70-$80 a case sort of beer brands.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a few out there that will do it where they'll drop it for a little bit just to kind of get the interest in the brand. I think you see with our Moondog quite a lot. I think you're on a Dan's these days, not these days, it was a few months back now, but they're about $60 a slab, which is pretty cheap. Now, that was kind of pre-COVID. But most of the craft guys, I mean, you should be able to get a pale ale case out to market retail for $80-$85. And if you can't do that, you've really got to think about what you are outsourcing and what kind of margin you're trying to get on your brand. Because, I mean, essentially you can accept a smaller margin if you're going to get more movement on those beers. Not that I'm trying to, the race to the bottom or whatever. But if you want to enter the slab market, it's not a bad place to be in terms of, like, getting movement, fresh movement of your stock. Where you're sitting on the shelf four pack at a time, it's kind of slow going some of the time. But I'd definitely love more craft guys to get into the slab market. I think there's a few guys kind of heading in that direction, but essentially, you know, you've got to be efficient with your production processes to be able to get there.
Mm.
The big guys love to push the fact that they're efficient and we're not. And, you know, we ask for all this other stuff because we're inefficient. I don't think that's always true. I think everyone's kind of learning what you've got to do to kind of make a dollar or two now. So
yeah, well, you're even starting to see the traditional 24 sort of cans or 24 pack Ks now pivoting towards, like, in the craft beer space, like Bolt are doing the 16 cans a case sort of thing, and coming in, I mean, I think they're selling their 16 packs at about $60 or $65, and when you start seeing that, it starts looking a little bit more attractive. But I mean, deep down, there's 8 cans less in the case, but it's still an opportunity to still get a, you know, a nice amount of beer from a brewery you like at a price point that you were used to paying before. But I don't know, it seems like a nice marketing ploy to sort of get into that. That's you've not seen, it's only normally your 24.
Yeah, 24 slabs. I think it works, and it's better for the consumer anyway, because they're not carrying a 9 kilo slab out of the out of the bottle shop. They've just got the 6. So look, I think it's, and you know, essentially Bolter had good marketing, and they got a big push behind their brand, and that would have helped having the 16 packs. But it's funny, because when we were at the Australian, we were selling 16 packs, and they just didn't move like that. They still sold predominantly as 4 packs. But you know, the Australian were always first of the party on a lot of stuff. But
they were in the packaging, weren't they? I know that they adopted one of the early adopters, or the adopters of the canning or packaging side of things.
Yeah, for a small guy. So that canning line's now at Yulee's. So they are.
Oh, is that where it went? Yeah. Okay.
So they're giving it a red hot go at the moment. But I think it's probably on its last legs, that guy.
I popped in there a couple months ago, and they were doing a canning run, and yeah, they've got the is it where the cans sit before it goes into the sort of canning line, and it's sort of like a big scaffolder with that just pushes all in. It looked a little flimsy to me.
Yeah, I think that probably came from the Australian as well.
Yeah,
but yeah, so
yeah, I think the Australian's got the new Palmer canning line.
Yeah, yep. So it's a funny one, that one. So when they have to run it, they're like halfway out the car park, but someone didn't measure something there. But
yeah, well, I think that's the only. It looks like they probably need a bit more space at the Australian. Or from what Dan was saying, he gave me a little tour of the brew house, and
it's looking pretty squishy at the moment.
Yeah,
yeah. Just before I left, so we'd made the plans to go increase it, because it was like the old Grifter one, so it was just the 2 vessel system. So it's a bit of a Frankenstein, bolted on a couple of extra vessels, and then they moved fermenters into the storerooms, and yeah, a bit of craziness going on there. But considering the size of the hotel there, they aren't. But yeah, like Dan said, they've gone further and further into that car park.
Well, that's their probably biggest advantage, the club. It's a massive venue, and a great way to trial new beers and to get their beers out to market as well. So
yeah, well, I mean, they've always run on a pretty small test system there as well. But yeah.
But I mean, you've got a massive venue there to sort of, you know, share with. So
yeah, and they definitely. But like Dan said the other day, they'd barely done a seasonal in 2 years.
Mm.
I was like, so bit of a shame, but doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. But they did say that they're going to start bringing that back. So
they did. Yeah. So they had the dark and tart and the Bavarian, something like that, Mandarin and Bavarian.
Yeah, and I know that they've got a decent seltzer range coming out now. And
Dan sent me a few of them. They were pretty good.
Yeah, which ones did you have?
All of them. So the mango, ginger.
Ginger, and the peach, yep. Yeah, no, it seems to be a big push for that as well, the seltzers through a beer trend, yeah.
Yeah, look, seltzers will take away a lot from cider, because they're just a drier beverage where it's easier drinking than what a cider is. What I think you'll find is ciders start to dry out a lot more to try and match the seltzer market. But yeah, I mean, there's a few different ways, obviously, you can make the seltzer. So seltzers, again, they're treated like beer in terms of excise, but that's only if you use rice, as dextrose is considered a simple sugar. So it's not considered, it's then taxed at the higher rate for seltzer. But then other guys prefer it on that, and they'll just use a base alcohol with soda water and fruit, just because it's a more stable product, essentially, supposedly stable. It's just simpler to make. You can scale it quite easily, and yeah. it works well.
Excellent. Well, for doing a small business and accounting episode, I didn't expect it for you to have so much industry insight on the actual beer side. So it's really refreshing. I'm glad that you're able to share that with some of the listeners, actually. So, any closing thoughts and advice that you'd like to share with people on maybe the small business and accounting considerations?
Just if you're going to get to a decent size, go to Unleashed pretty quickly. So what I find with most people is they come in having tried to use Xero's inventory system and it doesn't reassemble stuff for you, so they get pretty lost. Their profit and loss is a bit of a mess. So if you're going to have a decent setup, you're going to go pretty hard on the contract. Try and run with Unleashed pretty early. That'll give you a good idea as to how everything's going.
Okay, excellent. And anything you'd like to plug, opportunity to sort of, you know, talk about services, where they can maybe reach you and get in contact?
All right. So, look, we don't just work in the beer industry, like in the brewing side of things. So we also do bars, bottle shops. We do a bit of advisory for wineries. And as we mentioned before, we do distilleries as well. We look after the whole value chain, essentially. So everyone kind of goes in each other's territory. That's about it. If you need our details, you can find it on the website, or our details are on Brews News as well.
Yeah, excellent. Once again, Jared, I do appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing your advice on the accounting aspects. Everyone, that was Jared Wilson from Craft Accounting.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Build Me a Brewery podcast. That was part one of the small business and accounting considerations segment. Part two of the segment is live now, where I sit down with another accounting expert with direct experience in the brewing industry, Adam Wilson from Upside Accounting. Adam, he provides a lot of complimentary content and advice to that of Jared, so make sure you give it a listen to further your learning about the small business considerations of running a brewery. As always, if you are liking the podcast so far and find the content useful, please give us a follow and rating on whatever platform you're listening on. Also, follow us on our social media handles, as well as visiting our website, www.buildmeabrewery.com.au. Much more complimentary content will be coming your way if you sign up to our mailing list. I'm Chris Hayton, your host, and this is the Build Me a Brewery podcast.